Thank you, Nyanadara and friends. I'm not sure I've got much of a clue either, but we'll see how we do. So as Nyanadara has reminded you, yesterday morning I was speaking about this mysterious something. I hope that I made sufficiently clear that mysterious something was predicated upon the giving up of self-clinging. I hope it was sufficiently clear that what I was talking about was something transcendent. Transcending, that is the clinging on to a self and a literalized objective world. But I've been reminded that there's plenty of hostages to fortune in that manner of discussion. It's very easy to then sentimentalize such a notion. And one very often does hear such things sentimentalized. Sometimes, for instance, when one hears people speaking about the Bodhisattva or the Bodhicitta, something in one, well, in this one anyway, cringes. There's something rather sentimental about it. So I want to change modes completely this morning just to make clear, a little bit clearer, what I'm talking about. I want to give a sort of metaphysical, if you like, framework for what I'm discussing. And I'm going to do so necessarily in a somewhat compressed way. I'm going to condense an overview that I've just given at the LBC in a series of three rambles. So I'm going to pull those three rambles together in a single presentation. If you find what I say interesting, or you want to dispute with what I say, then please listen to the full set and quarrel with that. But I hope that given you're all within the order and therefore have been well trained in Bhante's teaching, it probably won't be necessary for me to say nearly as much as I said on that occasion. I began my series of rambles at the LBC referring to the Agni Agivachagota Sutta, which has always been a favourite of mine. It's the one with the ten avyakrita questions, the unanswerable questions about the finitude or infinitude of the world, etc. These have always fascinated me since Bhante first drew them to my attention. And as time's gone on, I found them more and more interesting. And I think they're one of the points where we can most easily see a connection between post-enlightenment Western philosophy and very early Buddhism. And very early Buddhism and later Buddhism, for instance, in the Prajnaparamita, etc. So I think it's quite a crucial little sutta. There are a number of others that do the same job in different ways. But that one has always intrigued me. For instance, it leads us into that apostolic succession of Hume, Kant and Schopenhauer, going on to even Nietzsche in a very interesting way. So if you remember the questions, I'm just going to focus on the fourth set of antimonies, which is concerning whether the Tathagata exists after death or not, or both exists and doesn't exist, or neither exists nor doesn't exist. And the Buddha's answer is, it's not even none of the above, which would in a certain sense be an acceptance of the terms of the question and a rejection of it within those terms, if you see what I mean. What he says is, I do not hold that view. I do not hold the view that the Buddha exists after death. I do not hold the view that the Buddha doesn't exist after death, etc. I won't labour the point. He doesn't hold the view. So why doesn't he hold the view? Well, the clear question that begs itself then is, what is a view? And I personally consider this to be an extremely important question, and I do think we need more of a living analysis of view within our presentation of the teaching. I think people need to understand much better what it is to have a view, what the danger in views is, and what the benefit in views is. I think often that people talk about the Dhamma without understanding what language itself means and what to think means, if you see what I mean. I don't say we need a training in logic or rhetoric, but we do need a training in view, what view means. In brief, a view, in the sense that the Buddha's using it here, is a theoretical understanding. And a theoretical understanding, of course, is built upon concepts that themselves are abstractions from our everyday perceptual experience. So we have our everyday perceptual experience. We generalize it in terms of particular concepts, table, so that we can recognize with the concept of table any new table that we encounter as a table, if you see what I mean. So concepts are derived from our perceptually based construction of reality and constructed in abstract. On that basis, we form theories about the nature of reality as a whole. And of course, in doing so, we make huge problems in thought. So, for instance, we think about existence and non-existence. Those are actually abstractions from the experience of something coming into our perceptual knowledge and something passing from our perceptual knowledge. But we take that passing, we abstract it into a great abstract idea of existence and non-existence, and then we start to speculate about it. We take our experience of things distributed around us and we form the idea of all things, in other words, the universe. And then we start to theorize on the basis of that grand abstraction that can never have any direct perceptual correlate, if you see what I mean. So the Buddha is essentially saying that here we are passing into a discussion without any tools to do it. All the tools that we have fail us, because all our tools are based in the abstraction of our perceptual experience, our experience within the world of appearances. And even that world of appearances, the Buddha himself told us, and later Buddhism is at great pains to demonstrate to us, even that a perceptual world as we construct it, as it appears to us and we construct it, is not as it is. It seems to us that there's a real solid world out there and a real solid self in here. This is what I've been quoting so much, but I like the phrase so much that I must say where it comes from. Schopenhauer calls the original disposition of the mind. It's like a very happy phrase. The mind is so disposed originally, in other words, from the cradle, to see things in terms of out there and in here. But Prakasha was reminding me of the Buddha's discussion again and again of the 18 dhatus that are the components of perceptual experience, all of which are dependently arising and relative to each other, relative to previous arisings, conditions, but which have no independent existence. We can never experience anything behind them outside or behind them inside. And this is something we can explore. We can even begin to immediately recognize. Yogacara, of course, pursues this same line in terms of Chittamatra, Vijñapti Matrata, which is probably the best expression of it. These cognitive elements, cognitions, that are merely cognitions. They appear to be messengers from something out there or a a messenger from something in here, so to speak. Doesn't quite work the same way there, doesn't it? Or somebody receiving the message in there. But you can never find that. If you examine the actual constituents of your experience moment by moment as they unfold, your perceptual experience as they unfold, you will not find anything beyond them. How can you? Because if it's beyond them, you can't find it, if you see what I mean. So it's imputed. But it's imputed so fundamentally, so instinctively, I think instinctively is the right term for it, very difficult to challenge and get at. So when we take concepts that are derived from our already delusive construction of our perceptual experience, the dreadful has already happened. We've already mistaken the nature of our experience by original disposition. We've already perceived it in terms of, or constructed it in terms of, solid in, solid out. On that basis, we form simplifications, abstractions, and on the basis of those abstractions, those concepts, we construct theories. We're so far from reality at this point that we begin to bump into ourselves. We see this, of course, in the field of logic, and this is partly what we're trying to do, for instance, in six-element practice. We're trying to chase down the illogic of our own original disposition of mind, if you see what I mean. We're trying to analyse experience so that we realise it's not as it originally presents itself to us. Or it's not even we do it. It just happens. It's instinct, I think. Best way of thinking of it. It's not what we do, it's what happens. We, as a constructed element within that, have to undo it, which takes us into paradoxical fields we will not explore today. So the Buddha's saying that, for what happens to a Buddha after death, even accepting all the terms in that fairly simple expression, none of our language does, because it all leads us to think of what happens after the Buddha dies as a continuation of appearance, if you see what I mean. So we cannot but think that what happens to the Buddha after death is that he goes on appearing in some way that is perhaps unimaginable to us. Of course, what the Buddha tells us is that that doesn't happen. Appearance stops. That's what parinirvana means. Appearance stops. Why? Because what fuels appearance is craving. All of this is happening because of craving. Because we've clung to the inner perceiving dimension as I, and the outer perceived dimension as world, solid field of experience existing independently. So we clung on to these attached to the inner perceiving dimension as I, and ordered our willing on that basis, we've perpetuated it again and again and again through beginningless time. The Buddha says, doesn't he, many a lifetime I have wandered in samsara, driven by craving, driven by grasping. It comes into being because of previous grasping, and grasping the present makes it happen again. Every time we cling, we ignite, so to speak, the karmic process which makes it all appear again. It's fundamental Buddhism. What the Buddha does is he gives up clinging. He realizes there's nothing to cling to, nobody to cling to. It's all a construction happening on the basis of previous conditions. Nothing to be gained from clinging, no happiness to be gained in clinging, no permanent happiness, that is, no body to do it anyway. And he just stops, he lets go. While he continues to have a body, perception continues to take place, although he's giving it no further karmic spin of conditioning. So the world of appearance continues to run itself out until the life force is run out. The life force, as it were, formed by previous conditioning, runs out. So the clock just stops because it's not being wound up again. If you can remember far back enough to the days before batteries and clocks and things like that. It just runs out. So the world of appearance ceases to appear because there's nothing to fuel it. So that then begs the question, what happens next? And the Buddha fundamentally says, says nothing. He speaks, of course, of it very positively. He makes it quite clear that it's something desirable, not merely in terms of, sort of peaceful blank, but he gives a strong impression of it as a positive something. It's something I speak metaphorically, if you see what I mean, from our point of view, a something. And what Bhante has emphasized again and again, it is necessary for us to give a even conceptually positive content to what happens at that point, because our understanding, our minds, even you could say, are predicated upon a distinctions. So if we deny something, if we say it's not this, it seems like a blank. And if it's a blank, it's deeply unattractive. It's very hard for us to orientate ourselves towards it. And yet, our Dhamma life is predicated upon a sort of provisional acceptance of will. Do you see what I mean? We accept the framework of an independent self and an independent outer world in order to end that acceptance. We can't do it otherwise. You can't just leap straight out of it, despite what the southern schools argue. It just is not realistic, if that is really what they're saying, which I doubt. Who's going to make the great sideways leap? You've still got to decide to leap sideways, and you've got to have an idea of a sideways towards which you leap. So our Dhamma life is predicated upon the acceptance of a willing self, which is, as it were, committed to going beyond the original disposition of the mind to what? That is the point that Bhante is making. We need to give what we're moving towards some positive content. Of course, the Buddha himself is an image that itself represents what is the other side of the Buddha at death. What is the other side of ending the original disposition of the mind? But we still need some conceptual content to that. And Bhante has spoken of that in a number of ways, which, if taken wrongly, of course, are highly problematic. The transcendental, the unconditioned, etc. And I've myself puzzled over all this quite a bit, and Sagramati had and I had quite a bit of discussion about this, and it lay in the background of my papers that based on my conversations with Bhante, for which I owe a great debt of gratitude to Sagramati. I have a preface that I keep intending to put into the seven papers, which acknowledges my debt to Sagramati, but I haven't got round to putting it in yet. It's there on my computer, honest. I don't say that he'd agree with everything I said. In fact, can you expect Sagramati to agree with anything that anybody says, least of all himself? But his very critical, but at the same time very faithful mind has been of inestimable value to me. And I'm deeply grateful to him. I think he's an enormous asset to our order. Somebody who's so deeply embedded in the order, so faithful to Bhante and the Buddha, and yet so critical, and sometimes so provocatively critical in a very useful sort of way. Mostly. I just had to say that, Sagramati. But I have to say, I've come round to accepting Bhante's point of view, that a notion such as unconditioned is useful and maybe even essential, so long as one recognises what it really means. And of course, in a way, I've already made it clear what it really means. What it means is unconditioned by craving, the craving that fuels the world of appearance. That's what it means, isn't it? It means what's, as it were, left, note the as it were, left when craving stops. It's what's left when this conditioned process of appearance ceases, because there's no fuel for it. The wood has gone, so the fire goes out in the classic image, although Indians would have viewed that differently in those days to the way we'd view it. They saw the fire as having, as it were, gone somewhere. Gombrich is very useful on that. But I think I agree with Bhante. Just investigating my own sort of way of seeing things, I need even a conceptual goal and a conceptual term that embodies, that encapsulates what passes beyond the world of appearance. Otherwise, I cannot but think of the ending of the world of appearance as an ending tout court. Nothing follows in any sense of the term, as a blank, a nihil, a nothing. But I think that for us in our Western mode. I don't think this is the same in India. In India, the greater danger is of thinking there's a great big Ishvara up there somewhere. Fortunately, today Ishvara was defeated in India, but that's another question. They tend to eternalism, in other words, rather than nihilism. But here, inevitably, if you deny the world of appearance, you think of a nothing. And I think that very large number of Buddhist nihilists, even perhaps tainting, dare I say it, some of our cases. We have such a slender grasp on what goes beyond the world of appearance, and such a crude and automatic rejection of anything that goes beyond it, that we inevitably fall into a nihilism when we deny. So Bhante says that we need a transcendental object. We need something that is objective, in other words, that we can think about, but that stands for what transcends the world of even objects, of subject and object. He borrows the term from Abhidharma, unconditioned. I want to just dwell for a little bit of a little moment on this idea of the world of appearance and its denial. If you really stop to think about what it means, if you reflect on the 18 Datus, if you reflect even on Vijñapti Matra, which is the same thing really, if you reflect on on Shunyata, you realize that all this that appears, this whole show that presents itself to us, although if you say it presents itself to us, it seems to be something out there happening to us, but we are part of this show. We are part of this show. This show that is our experience. Not to put too fine a point upon exactly what one means by experience. This show that we accept so readily, so automatically, with such a strong original disposition, is just that. It's just an appearance. It has no subjective independent existence as an owner. It has no objective independent existence as a field which is experienced. It's just an appearance. And this is something you can experience if you do the six element practice. If you reflect on your experience deeply enough. If you interrogate your experience in the vigorous way I talked about yesterday in Chintamayi Prajna, you can have that experience. You can see its appearance. Aesthetic experience is probably one of the strongest entries to that for many people, especially in the in areas of modern abstract painting, for instance, where I think the artists are very consciously playing with the constructed nature of experience and defying it. Minimalist music and so forth. Very, very interesting modes of art, which I think are post-Kantian, if you see what I mean. Kant made them possible. And Hume, of course. Just to satisfy Sagramati again, throw him a bone, a rather dry Scottish bone. You can have it with your porridge, in your haggis. Yeah. But that's what it is. It's a world of appearance. And I think the greatest problem today, and the characteristic underpinning of modern culture, is not what we've tended to call materialism, I've tended to call materialism, which I think begs questions about the nature of appearance, if you see what I mean. It's materialism, as a philosophical perspective, says something about what the nature of appearance is. That is a problem. I think the fundamental problem is what I call appearance-ism. In other words, accepting appearance as reality and as the only reality. So we're deeply embedded in that, just naturally as human beings, and as participants in the most highly adept technological culture there's ever been, with the most powerful religion there has ever been, which is technological consumerism. It's a religion, isn't it, which constantly gives its acolytes rewards. iPad. What number are we up to?
Six.
Six, thank you. I can hear a little hint of craving there. And you know, people like Apple are the high priests of the religion of consumerism, which delivers its believers evidence all the time of its success. A little matter of a financial world economic crisis and some little problem with the atmosphere may be interrupting the process, but I'm sure that saints will be invoked who can deal with that, some scientists somewhere. But we have the most embodied appearancist culture perhaps that there's ever been. Grand statement. I know them all, and this is the most. But it seems likely anyway. We're most deeply embedded in appearance. And we're very good at it. But every now and again, you know, like modern science gets to the point where appearance just doesn't work. And we badly need to recognize that appearance isn't everything. And if we prematurely deny something beyond appearance, which in a way in the end we have to, because beyond is a metaphor which derived from the world of experience, if you see what I mean, appearance. If we prematurely do that, we inevitably throw ourselves and others back on the world of appearance. So we need a transcendental object that stands outside appearance, but within appearance. Within appearance, but stands for outside it. It's a term, a concept, that we can grasp, but that is, of its very nature, ungraspable, if you see what I mean. And I, for the time being, offer the term unconditioned as a very good one, because it's explored quite fully in the early Abhidhamma, and I think Bhante's exposition of it in the Three Jewels is absolutely masterly. I do recommend everybody goes back to the Dhamma section of the Three Jewels, which I think is foundational for our perspective, if you see what I mean. It's unprecedented. I think, no doubt, there's quite a bit of tidying up to be done. But in its fundamentals, should stand us for many centuries to come. Both because it provides us with a perspective on Buddhist philosophy in general, and it provides us with a working, model for our own Dhamma life. So, I think that this way of thinking about what happens to the Buddha after death is necessary. We need to fill that space, even if we at the same time need to recognize what the Buddha is saying to Vajragotha. Unfortunately, because people are so ill-schooled in what a view is, in what a concept is, in what a thought is, they mistake their thoughts for things. And they mistake the thoughts that are meant to indicate beyond thought for thoughts and therefore for things, if you see what I mean. And I think we need to raise our own culture in that respect. I think we need to have a much finer appreciation of the nature of concept, the nature of thought, the nature of language, the nature of theory. I think don't need a philosophy, as it were, but we need a kind of basic schooling in Buddhist epistemology, you could say, so that we can then negotiate this difficult ground. Some people don't need this because they just got faith and that's fine. But most of us have brains as well, and actually shouldn't be allowed to use them because the L plates haven't come off yet. People are drunk in charge of a brain. Not me, of course. We think before we've even worked out what it is to think. Inevitably. So, yeah, I think this distinction between the world of appearance and what goes beyond the world of appearance, metaphorically speaking, in terms of a conditioned world and an unconditioned world, because in a sense it's a world, is necessary, so long as always we're applying the anatta doctrine, the shunyata doctrine, ultimately to it. But if you do that prematurely, you cut the ground away on which you need to tread to move forward. And that's a great fault in Western Buddhism, because we're cleverer than we are emotionally grown up, if you see what I mean. Let alone spiritually grown up. That's hardly happened at all. So I think that distinction is important. But of course, even if you accept that distinction provisionally, a problem arises. You make a distinction, so how are you going to relate the two elements that you distinguish? Because we know, is fundamental to Buddhist doctrine, that we, standing as we do within the world of the conditioned, can attain the unconditioned. We know that. But how can that which is unconditioned arise from that which is conditioned? This is a fundamental problem in theology, isn't it? How can God and creation be related? Because if God participates in creation, then what the hell is he doing? He made a right mess of it. If he doesn't involve himself in it, well, what's the point? Do you see what I mean? If he started creation, then where is he now? You know what I mean. If you make a distinction, perhaps an important distinction, between something transcendent and something imminent, or something created, how do you relate the two? We don't do it in that way in Buddhism, but nonetheless we're making a distinction. So I want to look at this in terms of three ways of relating the conditioned to the unconditioned. As I say, I've explored this a little bit more carefully and slowly than I can today. I did it in an hour. I'm going to have to do it in 20 minutes now in the last ramble. But I'd ask you to listen to all the rambles, because I've laid out my case quite carefully. Well, I've not done badly so far today. But Nana Varcha isn't giving me the thumbs up. So how do we relate the two? Bhante's very, very useful insight, which I don't know where, you know, what the antecedents for it are, is to discuss that relationship in terms of relationships in space and relationships in time. All our distinctions rest upon the fundamental building blocks of our experience. And, you know, two of the most fundamental of the fundamental building blocks are space and time. No space, no experience, because we can't distinguish between things. No time, no experience, because each moment is entirely discrete and exists completely independently of the next. So we can only have the experience that we have because we impose upon them the coordinates of space and time. Then when we're thinking, of course, we tend to think in a mixed mode, both space and time. We use both modes often in what we say, without really being aware of it, that we're using those metaphors, those archetypes, as Bhante says, the archetype of space and the archetype of time, in order to discuss our experience. So in discussing three ways of relating the conditioned to the unconditioned, I'm going to discuss, first of all, a spatial mode, and then two temporal modes. In the spatial mode, we've got, yes, the idea of space, the idea of the conditioned and the idea of the unconditioned as two analytically separate categories. Huh? So, how do we relate them to each other, as it were, spatially? Well, what you could say is that we locate one within the other. Do you see what I mean? If you think of two things in space, you can think of them as separate. You know, this stage is here, and off the stage is over there. So they're separate. Or you could think of them as coterminous, or at least one as being included in the other. So this chair is included in the space of this platform. So if we think of the world of appearance as being contained within the unconditioned, the world of the conditioned as contained within the world of the unconditioned, then we're arguing that when you examine closely, when you look into the conditioned, you will find the unconditioned. You will find that, as it were, behind it, beneath it, around it, permeating it, what it really is the unconditioned, is unconditioned, is unconditionable, is beyond condition. So, of course, our classic mode of such inquiry is the three lakshanas. We examine our experience, just as we did yesterday afternoon, moment by moment and in detail, if possible, the more in detail the better, in terms of the three lakshanas. So we look at it in terms of it being impermanent. And we examine our experience critically, to destruction, as I put it yesterday, to the point at which you're really convinced that it's impermanent. And at the point that you're convinced that it's impermanent, you understand it, you see it even, you could say, you directly experience it as animitta. You enter the vimoksha mukha of the animitta. Animitta means without distinguishing characteristics. Animitta is a sign or characteristic. It's, if you like, a logical designator. You know, if you want to define something, you provide a list of its defining features. This is an analysis derived from Western logical thought, but I think it applies. So what makes something distinct is that it has these characteristics. But, of course, if you see things in terms of impermanence, the boundaries blur. And one thing is not quite so distinctly different from another thing. We're at the tail end of autumn. And the famous example I remember when I studied philosophy, looking at substance and accidents theory in Aristotle, was the leaf changing colour. You know, you have a green leaf which then changes to red and then to a yellow and then to brown and then disintegrates. But the leaf persists. This is the Aristotelian theory. The substance persists. And even though this is a pretty bum sort of philosophical idea, which gives rise to the possibility of thinking that transubstantiation takes place in the Holy Communion, that even though it still appears as the wine and bread, really it's the body and blood of Christ. Honest. But it'll tickle the fancy of the Irish amongst us. I've distracted myself. if you think leaf as something sort of permanent and substantial, then you have to sort of explain the relationship of the different colours and different states of the leaf to its underlying reality. If you see it as impermanent, if your fundamental experience of it is as impermanent, you will simply see a constant flow of change. And you will not fasten your attention upon distinguishing characteristics. You'll be able to do that in communication. The Buddha says that the arahats use terms like I, me, mine, breakfast, and how do you do? Doesn't actually say that in the Pali, but they know they're just conventional terms. They know they have no objective reference. So if you penetrate through impermanence, you have an experience of animitta, things as being indistinct. Not indistinct in the foggy sense, but indistinct in the sense of being impossible to grasp some characteristic that you can hold on to. The image that always springs to mind is clouds. As I said in the LBC, I live amidst clouds in Wales. You have to, don't you, Prakasha? And when you try to sort of define the cloud, you can't. You can say cloud, but how many clouds are there? How many kinds of clouds are there? Even when you get into alto cirrus and cumulonimbus and lenticulate and so forth. Lovely lenticulate clouds in Wales. They don't do it, really, because every cloud is absolutely unique and different. And the nature of clouds tells you that, as it were. Even as your mind sees a whale or a camel, 'tis backed like a camel, you know it's not a camel. So you enter the gateway of the animitta. Then if you examine the anatta, the lack of selfhood internally and externally, you enter the gateway of shunyata. You realize that there is nothing behind it. There is no appearance that doesn't appear, if you see what I mean. Something that, as it were, obeys the rules of the world of appearance, but doesn't appear. That's what an Atman is. That's what a Dharma is, in the at least in the Mahayana's caricature of the Abhidhamma. There is nothing behind it. There's nothing independent, externally or internally. You realise it's not as a thought, not as an analysis, but as the way things appear to you. They unfold for you in that way. Of course, the mind's original disposition to present things in terms of a independent self and other persists. But that persistence is contained within a wider understanding, a wider awareness, that 'tis not so, but that it is a just as if. It's just a way of seeing. When you reflect on dukkha, the inevitable experience of suffering, and even the fundamental experience of suffering, because conditioned existence, existence within the world of appearance, is inevitably frustrating, unfulfilling, never arrives, promises so much, but never arrives. Just like trains used to be in Britain and sometimes are in India. They just never arrive. You feel it's going somewhere, but it never arrives. And it completes itself, fulfills itself. When you understand that, you go through the door of the apranihita, the directionless. I think it's interesting that the way in which it's usually translated, which is not exactly what I understand the Pali to mean, apanihita or pranihita, but directionless sort of suggests a space, doesn't it? And even in a way, time. So it means that your and desire is intimately connected with time. I was saying at the OBC that I learnt this very early on, going to an English public school, which, as every Englishman knows, is a private school, completely incomprehensible to foreigners. If you go to a boarding school, well, at my boarding school, which I didn't like much, there's a constant longing for the end of term and a constant dreading of the end of the holidays. And I began to realise that I couldn't stop it, but I began to realise that all the time I was living in the future, with a great longing for the future. When the future arrives and becomes the present, it's already a great dread of the future. And when that future arrives, it's already a great longing for the future. So the moment never flowers, it never stands still, it never fulfills itself. And so time and craving are intimately connected. I think they're part of the same thing. I think you could argue that time comes into existence because of craving, and craving comes into existence because of time, actually, if you see what I mean. They're absolutely intertwined. So the pranihita is where you let go of direction in the spatio-temporal sense of being attached to that. You are identified, if you can say identified in inverted commas, with awareness itself, rather than with its constructions in terms of space-time, conditioned arising, appearance, etc. All space-time, conditioned arising, appearance, etc. continue to arise so long as you have the body that is the result of previous craving. But you are no longer identified with it. You stand free of it. Simply aware as it flows past you. I read once of a Korean son master who is very, very important in medieval Korean Zen, who founded many monasteries and then retired to a hermitage and simply enjoyed the passing of time. He retired to the mountain and enjoyed the passing of time. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, nobody to be. That is the pranihita, as I understand it. And it's the gateway you enter when you reflect on the nature of dukkha. I'll add also the vimokshamukha of the shubha, with its corresponding, as it were, neo-lakshana of the ashubha. the unattractive, the disappointing, it's not necessarily the grossly ugly and horrifyingly disgusting. It can simply be the sense that however well the music is played, it's just not quite it. I've never heard a performance of what to me is the greatest piece of music ever, which is Bach's B minor partita for his partita number 2 for solo violin. I've never heard it played properly, and I've heard all the greats play it. There's something about them, there's something about the music itself that the performance never quite gets. So you think, oh, absolutely wonderful. But, so it's the ashubha is not necessarily the ugh, or the discordant, ugly note, or the colour that's out of harmony, or whatever, proportions that are wrong. It's not just that. It's the sense there's something more. Something more fulfilling, something more deeply attractive, which of course is the Shubha. That the Buddha said that I do not teach that when you see things as they are, you see everything as ugly. I say that when you see things as they are, you really know what the beautiful is. So this is looking at the world of appearance and seeing it underlain by, surrounded by, even made out of unconditioned, the unconditioned, what is unconditioned, what is impossible to understand solely in terms of the language and thought and theory that derives from appearance. And this is one of our major practices. This is spiritual death practice. This is insight practice. It's looking into the world of appearance and recognizing that it is a gateway to what lies beyond it. It's a gateway to what happened to the Buddha after he died. So that probably there's more to say about the spatial exploration of the spatial relationship between conditioned and unconditioned. But probably more important, and especially for us, because of Bhante's great emphasis on it, is the temporal relationship between the conditioned and the unconditioned. Of course, it's not that the unconditioned arises in dependence on the conditioned. I think this is a little bit of a way of speaking that's not correct. Of course, the unconditioned cannot arise in dependence upon the conditioned, because that would be to condition the unconditioned. But of course, the realization of the unconditioned arises as the end point of a conditioned process. I think that's quite an important rider to that discussion I don't often hear made. So we can relate the conditioned to the unconditioned temporally, in time, by recognizing that there are a sequence of steps and stages, a sequence of conditioned arising that arise in dependence upon a, in Bhante's term, spiral kind of conditionality, that arise in dependence on skillful karma, which works with a karmic kind of conditionality, and then with dharma niyama, the series of processes that lead, once one has decisively transcended self-clinging, right to merging into, to use that metaphor, with the unconditioned. Our language of the of the spiral path, of the path of conditioned arising, our language of karmic karma niyama, our language of dharma niyama, is mainly a language to do with the spatial relationship of where we are now with, if you like, the goal, the unconditioned in my terms now. And it's extremely important. And probably we still need to place an enormous amount of attention upon it. Even if you have some degree of insight, you can bet your bottom dollar, and you can see it in some people very clearly, there's a lot of work to do on the karmic level. the vehicle is still not up to the insight. There's a lot of work still to do at the karmic level. There's a problem. I'd be very interested to explore it more, and maybe Sagarmati's got something to say about it, but the relationship between Vipassana and Shamatha, because it's quite clearly acknowledged in the Pali Canon that you can have Vipassana without Shamatha, but you must get Shamatha once you've had Vipassana, if you see what I mean. Very interesting to explore that more fully, see what's said. We work first of all at the karmic element, and then the dhammic unfolds. So we're brought closer and closer. The conditions themselves bring us to the moment when we can make that great sideways leap. It's not that we make it by that time; it just happens. And when our bodies go, when they exhaust their fuel, then we enter that unconditioned dimension, to use a transcendentally objective term, understood in the light of everything I've already said, I hope. So that's probably, for most people, still the main way in which they need to work. They need to think about relating the unconditioned to the conditioned by way of a spiral process. And, of course, using the other two methods that I'm going to mention, that I'm going to complete, in parallel. But the major emphasis, probably for most people, until very far on in the process of approach to the unconditioned, is basically the plodding work of moving in time in accordance with skillful action. That's probably more essential than we realize. And putting our complete confidence in karma. That karma, a skillful karma, does grow us on the spiral path. So then what about the third method? And we have to be much briefer, even though this is by far the most appealing, and which brings us back to yesterday morning. So we can think of... In this model, this temporal model or temporal mode of thinking, don't like the overuse of the term model. This temporal mode of thinking is sort of the idea is that we are going up towards the unconditioned from the conditioned. We're moving towards the conditioned, because if you've got two things, you can approach one to the other. But of course, it's only one side of it. It is also true to say that the unconditioned is approaching us. The unconditioned is coming towards us. And when you think about the first model that I used of looking within the conditioned and seeing the unconditioned in its depths, that must be true. Because the world of appearance is always provisional and relative and never a reality. And insofar as it's never reality, there must always be a mismatch between reality and the construction that the world of appearance delivers to us. Do you see what I mean? We don't do it. It happens to us that we construct reality in a certain way, and then we begin to build upon that in the most wonderful constructions and creations. But it's always more or less out. It always, more or less, doesn't fit the case. That's what dukkha is, isn't it? The ill-fitting wheel, as the false etymology, fanciful etymology gives it. That sense that although the cart is moving, it's bumping up and down, and it has to be said the wheel eventually falls off or shatters under its burden. So, reality is always pressing in upon us. The unconditioned is always defying our attempts to contain it, our attempts to understand it, to fit it into a Procrustean bed of theory and concept, even of just seeing. It's always refusing to fit. Usually we've got well-developed mechanisms for ignoring that. We've got ways of putting sticking plaster on it, patching it up again. Ignorance, ignoring in the sense of one of the three unwholesome roots, is specifically, I would say, refusing to acknowledge the ever-present reminders that appearance isn't what it appears to be, if you see what I mean. That's what ignorance is. It's an active refusal to see what is plain to anybody who chooses to examine at all their experience. It just isn't like that. And, death is the great defier, but there are many little deaths and little moments of death. The collapse of a cherished self-image. Often we experience in relation to other people when we clash with somebody who just doesn't see us the way we want to be seen. It can be quite disturbing, quite deeply disturbing, and sort of almost existentially disturbing, because jolly well is existentially disturbing. It challenges the very roots of our self-idea. And what we find at the bottom of it is a little voice saying, but I exist, I'm me. And it's defied. I am special. And so, of course, reality is always coming towards us. Of course, reality is breaking in on us all the time. The unconditioned is breaking through our very, very rudimentary and a gimcrack construction of reality. It never quite works. A bit like Canute and the tide, or the dikes holding back the ocean. Sorry, the Dutch holding back the ocean, but they're always pressing in and aren't being undermined. Reality is always defying our constructions of it. And of course, I'm speaking at the moment, as it were, in an unpleasant, uncomfortable way, the way it defies us, making us uncomfortable. But it also is coming to us in very appealing ways, in glimpses of the beautiful, even within the manifestations of beauty within the world. I hope Chintamani won't mind my saying, I've just seen the one of the processes in the production of the Vajrasana Rupa, which is stunning. And even though, you know, it's still, two stages away from being the final object, it's so easy seeing that to sort of pass beyond it to the beauty of the Buddha. Of course, however skilled Chintamani is, he cannot create the beauty of the Buddha, because it's unconditioned, it's beyond, and he's using conditioned material to do it. But the sufficient reflection of the unconditioned in that image for one so quickly to relate to it in that way. Of course, you know, in the end, any image, if you sit in front of it long enough, it does that. But I saw it, and the first glimpse I had opened up to me vistas beyond the material in front of me. And great works do that in the field of art. Aesthetics, I think, is one of the most important ways, roots into a relationship with the unconditioned. And again, a lot of modern artists are highly conscious of this. They're highly conscious of the need to defy and trick you into perceiving in a more unconditioned way. They have ways of making you talk. They have ways of making you see the unconditioned, because they give you something that you just can't quite put into words. I went to the Matisse exhibition with Amoga City and a Miro exhibition with Amoga City and Chandrasheel, and we sat in front of those huge white canvases. Talked about this many times, but Chandrasheel's here, so I'll do it again. Huge white canvases with just a few shapes in primary colours, bold primary colours, and a single wavering line crossing down them. And we sat for a long time sitting looking at them, and I was thinking, oh God, what are they going to be making of this? You know, modern art. Because frankly, they're quite artistically uneducated, if you see what I mean, certainly in our Western modes. But Chandrasheel turned to me and he said, my mind is constantly trying to understand what it is and it will not let me. And I thought, Miro would be so happy. It got it. What Miro is trying to do is to take you into, as it were, the pure experience. And I noticed after that, walking out into the gallery and seeing everything in that same way. So aesthetic experience is a big opener into that sort of sense of the unconditioned as coming towards us. It's the sense of faith, when you feel strongly drawn, sometimes just to a something. I remember this very early in my life. I couldn't accept God. I knew there was something. And I was drawn to it very powerfully and unsatisfied by everything that I came across. I remember first coming across Buddhism and feeling, yes, this is it. And it was very much as if the Buddha was coming for me. The sense is that something's coming to find you. Something's constantly pressing in on your very immature provisional construction of reality that's offering you freedom, offering you something greater. And of course, all our practice of what we call spiritual rebirth, I prefer these days to call dhammic rebirth because of the connotations of spiritual nowadays, and especially in India, its translation is adhatmic. The dhammic rebirth is a conscious opening up to the unconditioned as it's calling to you. And I do the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana, in which the centerpiece of the sadhana is the recitation of the stuti, the verses of praise. And probably most of you know that those verses come to you from Manjushri's heart. And it's a strange sort of... doesn't bother me, but until you start thinking about it, it's strange that he's sort of telling you how to praise him. But I don't think of it like that. It's as if from him, the capacity to praise him arises. And I realise that in that praising of Manjushri, I'm deep in communication with Manjushri. Manjushri is calling to me. He's, in a way, well... He's not in a way. He is telling me who I really am. He's opening up me up to reality as it really is. And all I have to do is open myself to that, you know, using the form of the practice, which is quite strictly sort of structured. If you just follow that structure and open yourself up, Manjushri is there. Manjushri is reality. And all appears from that perspective. So we can relate to the unconditioned by seeking it within the conditioned, within the world of appearance. And if we seek it with rigor, exploring the limits of the construction itself, then we will find the unconditioned. Jnana Varcha has been reminding me that this is, of course, what's happening in modern physics, in quantum physics. As you explore and examine the nature of subatomic particles, you arrive at the end of our, you know, classic subject-object construction of the world, and you have to then resort to such wonderful magical ideas as multi-dimensional universe or simultaneous universes, which to me is much, much more complex than saying, oh, I have no clue what's going on. I heard scientific theory described as a sophisticated statement of ignorance. This is extremely sophisticated statements of ignorance. But what I'm indicating is that when you really examine the grounds of appearance, they begin to break up. And that's what our exploration in terms of the Lakshanas, and I suggest the fourth sort of honorary Lakshana of the Asubha, that's what they do. They take you to the limits of the conditioned and reveal to you the unconditioned. But that always has to be put within the context of the work within the conditioned to create the conditions by which you can slowly approach the unconditioned. If you don't do that, the others become either mainly intellectual, and then when you do have some experience, it's a grasping at experience. I think it's a great danger with modern practice, which is derived from very high teachings, that you can have the, you know, some definite experience, but you fit onto it preordained lingo that then fixes the experience and forms a kind of atta again, atman again. So very, very important to continue the solid work of building up the conditions, especially through karma, through sila, basic samadhi, positive mental states, participation in a community, because if you don't participate in a community, you just refine your own individuality, individualism. It becomes a tiny little world. Maybe very beautiful, very bright, very pure, but it's just tiny. And it has to be mixed with the world, especially through community, through participating together in the work to transcend. I cannot stress this element enough, and I hope that came out sufficiently yesterday. So one's approaching the unconditioned in the form of community, in the form of a transcendental community or a transcendental reality expressing itself in community at its best, and that you are working together to create, because then we get beyond ourselves. Same time, well, yes, we open up to that transcendent reality through practice, through meditation practice, that is, through meditating upon the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, etc. So much one could say here. But also by opening up to the order, opening up to our teacher, opening up to some force that somewhere or other is at the back of it all, which Bhante famously spoke of as a suprapersonal force that founded the order through him. This is not just rhetoric. Yes, it's poetic language, not to be rarefied in philosophical terms. And, you know, you get sort of when people start talking about, oh, I experienced a suprapersonal force last night. You know, so you want to know what Geiger counter you use to measure it. It becomes so appearancist. It's meant to be used very lightly and probably only once by one person, and then explored in a very meaningful way by another. But that's what he's saying. He's saying that from his point of view, his experience is that his work to found this order and this movement came from something beyond himself. That's what he's saying. That was his experience. And that, looking back, was my experience of him. I never got the sense of somebody who's sitting there with a master plan with a strong desire to put himself at the centre of things. Bhante has quite a healthy self-appreciation, and he's prepared to fight his own corner fairly vigorously. Well, very vigorously. But I've never sensed that the work itself is egotistical. He believes in it very strongly. He understands his own place in it very clearly. But when he talks about it like that, you never sense that it's about him, if you see what I mean. And the order has within it that something that brought him to create it. It now does live independently of him, amongst us. And I think we are ready to let Bhante go physically. May he live long as it's a good life for him. I think it's not so easy now. I don't wish him to remain any longer than he wishes to remain. But I wouldn't want him to go before he has to, as it were. But I don't think we need him anymore. We've got him within us forever, as long as we remain faithful to what he has given us, and especially to that indefinable something through which he, or from which he, founded our order and movement. And as long as we realize it's worth making the effort, sometimes the difficult effort, of aligning ourselves with each other, of setting aside cherished positions, never setting aside real values, because real values, real dhammic values, cannot ever be excluded. But their forms, their modes of expression, even their roots into them, maybe need to be rethought, remoulded, readapted. And that needs to be negotiated, needs to be discussed. Public preceptors have to, because we need somebody to do so, play the key part in that, as Bhante says in that the second interview, the first interview. But they have to do it with everybody else because of the nature of what it is we're trying to channel. The public preceptors can't have it alone. It has to be shared by all. They are the guardians of its gates, only in the sense that somebody has to be and everybody has to be. But if everybody has to be, then nobody is. Bhante said that about private about property belonging to us at the London Buddhist Centre in the old days, that it has to be in somebody's responsibility. Because if it's in everybody's responsibility, it's in nobody's responsibility. So somebody has to have that perspective, especially, although everybody has to have it to some degree. And we all need to recognise the worth of it, the desirability of making that little bit of effort, that little bit of discipline, to align ourselves with each other so that we can better manifest this transcendent force, this unconditioned principle that, as I said at the beginning, I was able in my own, you know, limited self, to somehow communicate to people living in the worst conditions I've ever seen human beings live in. Just a little sliver, a little reflected reflection of a reflection passed through me to people there. And I really hope that we all deeply appreciate and value this. Mustn't ever become rigid or stiff or Procrustean in that sense. So we cut things off just because they're not in the book. But at the same time, it mustn't be so open that, you know, just because it's sort of nominally Buddhist, it's okay. So I hope that I've made my case sufficiently. I hope I've given you at least some perspective on the more sort of, let's say, metaphysical perspective on what I talked about yesterday. And then in the afternoon, I gave at least a little glimpse of a practice-based approach to it. And let's see what you all make of it, and everybody else makes of it who happens to see this or hear it. Thank you. Mm-hmm.